What is your full name?
My name is Emma Bernardin Bawarshi.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My name is Jeanette Lee, and the interview date is October 1st, 2010. And I'll just put this over here since it's like right in between us. Okay. Well, I guess we can start with the first question, and then, you know, if other questions kind of develop out of what you've said, we might, you know, go a little
deviate somewhat. Okay.
Yeah, this is just, you know, guidelines.
What brought me to the Bologna Center, interestingly enough, was the Dean of Students at my undergraduate school. I went to Hunter College, the city of New York, and was majoring in international affairs. And she knew, the Dean of Students knew that I was trying for a graduate degree, but I was mostly concentrating in the economics area. And called me down one day and said, we've got this wonderful program going at Johns Hopkins University for Western European studies. She said, you have a really good chance based on your undergraduate work of being accepted. She said, I think you should apply for it. So she gave me all the materials, and I brought them, took them home, and hemmed and hawed whether I wanted to go into another international affairs program. I was thinking more that I needed to focus in one direction or another. But the more I read through the material, the more I thought, I can't pass this up. They offered a scholarship which involved tuition, room and board, and transportation. So I sent in the application and then received a call one day asking me to come down to Washington for an interview. And shortly after that was notified that I was accepted. So it was through the Dean of Students at Hunter College that I learned about the Bologna Center.
Oh, wow. Okay. And had you been abroad before that, or was this your
No, first this is my absolutely first experience overseas.
Oh, okay. And so what was your impression then when you first...
Well, my family, you know, my father's family were all immigrants to the United States, and they came, they were born in Germany, but lived in Italy because they had a German grandmother and an Italian father. So I was very at home in a Italian-German-speaking world, so to speak. I really felt comfortable in Italy right from day one because I could pretty much understand almost everything that was going on around me. And although I had never lived there, I had heard enough about it that it was somewhat familiar to me. So I spent some time with family in the northeastern part of Italy, in the Udine area. Old-timey people, you know, that only spoke the Friulano language. They didn't even speak Italian. And then when I came to Bologna was just the big city after living in the pre-Alp area of Italy. So I was delighted with Bologna. I loved it from day one. I was rooming with the other American girls, and the first place we stayed, there was just the American girls living together. Then we, after a month or so, we moved into a pension, mm-hmm. and then there was an Austrian student who joined us. So there were six of us living together.
And were the six of you the only women in the?
No, there were two. There were at least two others. That's Gail Schwartz and Françoise from France, who didn't live with us. I think they may have shared another living area, but I don't know exactly where they lived. We had classes together, but we didn't really get together outside of school at all. But the six of us who lived together pretty much formed a pretty strong social bond, mm-hmm. and we did a lot of things together and maintained our friendship after we left Bologna to a large extent.
And now, what kinds of activities would you do when you weren't in class?
Well, one of the girls, Christine, another American girl, and I would constantly go into the movies because we said it strengthened our language skills. Mm. The movies were American movies, but they all were dubbed in Italian. Oh. So it was great, you know, Frank Sinatra speaking Italian, and I can't tell you, you know, whenever the movies changed, we would be there for the new movie. So we always said this was not exactly, you know, shirking our responsibilities scholastically or whatever. It was really an strengthening of our cultural absorption or whatever. Mm-hmm. But we did that, and we went out to eat as much as we could afford to. Walking everywhere, of course. Getting together with other students for just gab fests. The Europeans, especially the German and the Austrian students, were great talkers, as evidenced today at lunch. And interesting to talk to, you know. So I'm very open to discussing all kinds of things, you know. I mean, they didn't bridle necessarily when you asked them how they felt about the fact that their parents and grandparents were responsible for the Second World War, basically. They didn't shy away from answering questions like that. So it was really interesting.
Oh, that is very interesting. And at the time, it was during the Cold War now, sort of the
oh, yeah.
early
it was,
Cold War.
That was why the emphasis was on Western European studies, because Eastern European countries or developments rarely were broached at that point. Mm-hmm. So that's all changed, of course. Now that's broadened to cover the whole of Europe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. And what was your most, I guess going back to the question list, what is your most vivid Zeiss memory? Is it going to the movies, or was there another event? Did you travel, do a lot of traveling, or anything like
I didn't.
That?
I had been introduced to a friend of our family who lived in Florence. Mm-hmm. And whenever I could get away from Bologna, I would go visit her and her. She was a single woman who lived with her mother. She would take me around Florence, show me all the museums, and she was a wonderfully warm person, and I'd visit them very often. That was always an interesting weekend that I'd go spend with them. The other thing was, I was just delighted with the fact that Bologna, which seemed, even though it was just 10 years after the war, to me, I didn't see very much evidence of the war in Bologna. I was told there were pockmarked buildings and so forth. I never saw them. It was, I thought, quite affluent, mm-hmm. very sophisticated. I love the fact that it had a communist government, because they were all capitalists. They lived like capitalists. Mm-hmm. They flaunted their their affluence. They didn't pay taxes if they could possibly avoid it. Why they had a communist government, I don't know, except that they all kind of, turned their head when they weren't supposed to notice something, and it was a live let live philosophy between them, I guess. Mm-hmm. That just tickled me, that this would happen in this city like this.
And now, being an American in Bologna in sort of the post-war years, did you feel any effects?
Actually, I got to meet a few native Italians, not related, not associated with the Bologna program itself. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel any resentment. They were very receptive of Americans. You know, there was kind of a, I don't know, kind of, they enjoyed our or gaucheness, maybe, to some extent, encouraged you to speak their language, and even though they might have laughed behind your back at the way you said things, but they were friendly. I mean, I thought they were very open to Americans. I never felt any feeling of strain in meeting with them.
And now, sort of shifting back to school, do you remember what courses you took, and if so?
I remember, well, you know, the premier course of the center was the course on European integration, which was taught by Professor Haynes, the founder of the Bologna Center, and a number of visiting dignitaries, and it went into all the steps leading up to what they hoped one day would be complete European integration. And there were just many steps being taken then. Three countries getting together to form kind of a common market or to share their economic philosophy, so to speak. But the expectations were so high that this would develop into a full-fledged common market. Well, it did to a certain extent, because we do have the European Union, but I don't know that it developed exactly the way that it was foreseen then. Mm-hmm. But this was the, I thought, one of the premier courses of the center. I also enjoyed other courses that I took. We had a Frenchman, a young French professor, Alfred Grosser, who taught French Union labor movement, and an Italian law professor who later became a judge. I think Mancini was his name. He taught the Italian labor movement. And they would feel the class out. If they felt the class was able to handle it, they would teach in the language French and Italian, and that was an experience too, because it so widened your vocabulary in that language, because the need to know vocabulary that you picked up just by dealing with your landlady, your pension owner, and going to the shops and whatever. Didn't necessarily make you sound like you were a graduate student. So to be able to learn some vocabulary in your chosen field was also rather important. But anyway, those were interesting classes.
Oh, that sounds great. Wow, I kind of wish I went to Bologna now. And now, we sort of touched on this, but your most vivid memory of Bologna and of Italy in those years.
Yeah, I think I pretty
Those
much
are,
did.
You feel
yeah.
like you covered that. Okay. And now, after you, when you were at SAIS, what was, what field of study were you?
Well, you know, going to SAIS, it started in Bologna, but it continued at here in Washington. It helped give me focus. You see, I was so reluctant to go into another broad field, international affairs, because I thought I'm right back where I started from. How do I specialize in anything specific enough for employment? But it was there I started thinking along the lines of foreign service officer. So that's what happened. When I got back to Washington, I took the exam, which was both a written and an oral exam, and I was accepted. And I think really it was instrumental in focusing me in that career, on that career path.
What specifically about SAIS helped you do?
Well, actually talking to other students, because they had already gone through this process, and quite a number of them had decided on this track. And it gave me the idea, this is exactly what I was thinking I'd like to do, but didn't think of it on my own.
And now during the course of your career, I guess, how did SAIS affect you or help you?
Well, you get such a breadth of academic studies, all of which come into play. You know, I mean, your assignments in the Foreign Service might be economic, they might be political, so, and you bring to it this whatever coursework you've done, of course. The historical portion of your studies always comes in handy. The language requirement was instrumental in functioning professionally in the Foreign Service. You were expected to have a working knowledge in at least one other language other than English, and that was an important part of your final exam, showing that you could do that. So I think the background that I got at SAIS was very important in fulfilling my job requirements.
Mm-hmm. And now all of you downstairs have kept in touch. All of you were in the Bologna program.
Yeah, and have kept at in the touch same time we were there in the inaugural class, which was kind of made us special. And we haven't, some have kept in touch throughout the years, because they've gone to all the reunions, like Mary Lee Lincoln, she went to most of the reunions. Mm-hmm. I did not. This is the first time I've been to a reunion.
Oh, wow.
And then it helped that it was here in the United States. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've kept in touch from time to time as things came up. Someone would take the initiative and find out how to get in touch with the rest of us. Mm-hmm. And Mary Lee Lincoln and Joe Dukert have been wonderful at doing that, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and we've always been, they've all had such interesting lives that, you know, you really look forward to hearing from them, no matter how many years it's been since you've heard from them.
Mm-hmm. And now can you talk about your life in the Foreign Service? And how?
Yeah, well, it was brief. It uh-huh. was wonderful, but brief.
Uh-huh. What made it so wonderful?
Well, first of all, the year that I went into the Foreign Service, which was in 1957, was the first year that they had such a large incoming group of women. Wow. Women were still a rare commodity in the Foreign Service back in the 50s, mid-50s, mm-hmm. late 50s. And also, they started accepting people from areas not necessarily Ivy League, you know, Midwest, West. That was a new thrust. And I did 1 year internship at the Department of State in their Bureau of Economic Affairs, and then was assigned to Kampala, Uganda in East Africa. And there I met the man that I married. Our assignments were usually 2 year assignments. Mm-hmm. Mine went a little longer than 2 years because the government was having one of its usual budget crunches, mm-hmm. and no one was going to be allowed to travel. Mm-hmm. But then the person who had been assigned to replace me in Kampala arrived with his wife and family, and they needed the residential facilities that I was occupying. So they said, well, Switzerland needs, the embassy in Bern needs a person with French language background. We'll send Emma there. So it was a direct transfer from Kampala, Uganda to Bern, Switzerland. And
did your husband move with you?
No, he wasn't my husband then. Okay. We had kind of started just seeing each other. Uh-huh. But that was, I was in Switzerland when he wrote and said, I think we should get married.
Oh, he wrote you, proposed to you by mail?
Yeah. I said, well, I have to talk to my family. I don't know about this. So I went to talk to my boss, first of all, mm-hmm. the political officer at the embassy. And he said, look, the reason you came here is because my wife and I have to go back to the States. We're way overdue taking our home leave. So don't do anything until we come back from home leave, and then I'll be happy to talk to you. Mm-hmm. And so when they came back 3 months later, we talked about it, and he goes, by all means, accept the marriage proposal. But you're going to do it the right way. You're going to request permission to get married, which is the way they tell you to do it, which is the way all the men do it. Uh-huh. He said, they're not going to give you permission, but you're going to ask for it. And you'll have to send a letter of resignation along with that request for permission to marry. So we did that.
And oh, of course you had to resign from the Foreign Service if you wanted
they
to.
Accepted the they would accept the resignation if they declined the permission. Oh, and they did decline permission. Mm-hmm. Invariably with women.
Okay.
Back then.
With men, though?
No. Oh. With men, they would go so far as to at least initiate a security clearance of the spouse-to-be.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then if there were problems, or if maybe there were even problems with the person himself, the employee, they might decide, well, you know, who wants to, we don't want to bother with this. Uh-huh. But anyway, they, no, they regretfully accepted my resignation because they couldn't accept, they couldn't grant the permission to marry.
For a woman.
For a woman. Okay. I mean, they didn't say it for a woman, but they would not consider it.
And did your husband, he
was not an American.
Oh, okay.
See, he was a local person, so uh-huh. that may, meant that it would be rather arduous for them to have conducted a clearance on him and all the background check necessary, whatever, but it wasn't done. Mm-hmm. It was just the system at the time, uh-huh. and we knew it, but we went through the motions.
I see.
So I went back to Kampala, Uganda, got married, and we lived there for 2 more years, during which I worked as a resident staff person at the it was the consulate general at that point, mm-hmm. and then also with the AID mission there. Mm-hmm. At that point, Uganda had gotten its independence. The company that my husband was working for decided that they would dissolve rather than continue their operations there. They tried to sell it and it weren't very successful, so they just dissolved the corporation and moved back to South Africa, which is where they came from initially. And my husband and I came to the United States. It was my husband's first trip to the United States.
Oh my goodness! So he's Ugandan?
His background is Lebanese, but he was actually born in at that time it was Tanganyika. Now it's Tanzania.
Okay.
So he was born in Dar es Salaam, but he was working in Uganda at the time I was there.
Okay.
So we came to set up residence in New York, which was my hometown, mm-hmm. and lived in New York for 10 years when he had the opportunity to go to Houston and start a job there, and he loved Houston.
Really?
He hated New York because Houston was more like Africa to him.
Oh, right. That makes sense. Yeah. Okay.
And
so was it the oil business?
Back in 73, no, he was, my husband was an accountant, and actually he could have worked anywhere. Uh-huh. Which is what I said, you know, when I asked, I said, you know, he won't have trouble finding a job no matter where the Foreign Service sends me. That didn't work out. But anyway, he ended up working for steel companies and being kind of a manufacturer's representative in Houston. Mm-hmm. But it was, Houston was still grown up back in 73 when we moved there. Mm-hmm. It's become a very much bigger city with a very diverse population. Mm-hmm. But it's easy to fit in there, you know, there are so many different cultures that live there. So he was happy there and we raised our children there, and I went to work once the children were all settled in school with the Houston Public Library, because it was, I could use some of my academic background as a reference librarian, and it was a rather a fulfilling job. I loved it. And then the Institute of International Education expanded its regional offices to include Houston, and I got a job there as a foreign student. They I don't know if you realize this, but they supervise a lot of the scholarship programs for foreign graduate students, such as Fulbright and some of the other programs. Mm-hmm. And so we advise students who were in the States under some of these programs that we were contracted to assist with. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I did that for several years.
So did you get to use your language skills in that job?
Quite often, yeah. They would the area that I was overseeing were the southeastern schools in the southeastern United States that had foreign students under these any of these programs, Fulbright or others, mm-hmm. In Florida, Georgia, Alabama, North and South Carolina. Mm-hmm. So I would travel to those campuses quite often and meet with the students, see if there was anything that they needed help with, or. And they would call us if they had problems or questions. They always say, "You're my mother away from home," mm-hmm. when they'd call. Yes, and they'd come to Houston to visit too.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a great job.
That's great because you kind of get to stay in the States and raise your family and be settled,
yeah.
but also be
still have that international connection. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, wow. It's kind of ideal, I think. And well, I guess that sort of segues into this last question, which is, you know, you've had a very successful career and managed to balance home life with, you know, work life, it seems. So what advice would you give to, you know, students at SAIS today?
I don't know so much SAIS as at the Bologna Center, if mm-hmm. they're at the Bologna Center. We were, as the inaugural class, we had very little in the way of, we were borrowing space from the University of Bologna. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a proper library. Mm-hmm. And so I know that has all changed. I've been to Bologna since then, not in an official capacity, but I visited the building they have there. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've got a real wonderful setup there now. But get away from the campus as much as possible, you know, mix with the people, just soak in the culture, you know, take advantage of the fact that you are in another country, in this wonderful, wonderfully exciting city, or travel around that city even. Do things that you couldn't have done at any other school setting. I mean, you can study and you can go to the library anywhere. You can be in Washington, D.C. or anywhere. Mm-hmm. Do the things that you can't do anywhere, mm-hmm. and take advantage of those things. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, you have to put in the hours of study, but to take advantage of that, I think, is making the best use of your time there. Mm-hmm.
Anything else? Or actually, what do you tell the students that you, or what did you tell the students that were studying in the U.S.? And, you know, what issues did they encounter as foreign students here? I mean, are there any lessons that, you know, SAIS students might be able to apply?
They were all graduate students, so they were fairly sophisticated. Mm-hmm. And, especially if they came from Europe, mm-hmm. they were accustomed to traveling. Mm-hmm. And many of them had several languages mm-hmm. That they were proficient in. Mm-hmm. There wasn't very much. I mean, you could tell them more or less how to get along with Americans, kind of, you know. Europeans can get very intense. And they're also more private in terms of social relationships. I mean, an American will sit down with a complete stranger and in 10 minutes you'll know how many wives he's had, yeah. what his mother and father did, and, you know, how many children they have. Europeans are not like that necessarily. You have to go through a whole ceremony to become familiar enough with each other to start delving into personal issues, you know. So there are these differences, and you had to sometimes make the foreign student aware. You know, Americans seem so open, but they may not even recognize you the next time you see them because, you know, they're open with everybody, but they're not actually necessarily focusing on you as an individual or a friend for life. And so this would come as a surprise to the foreign students, say, oh, but we spent so many hours together the other day, and he acts like he doesn't even know me. And things like that. But anyway, you're dealing with a pretty sophisticated group of people, though, so it wasn't, things like that didn't often come up. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting mingling with them, because they all have, I used to love to get their perceptions of is the United States the way you expected it to be, and very often it was not.
Oh.
And like there was a program that we oversaw that was the South African education program, SAEP. It was SAEP, South African Education Program, and a lot of these South African students would come and say, you know, we really expected the United States to be a primarily black country, like Africa, where the majority population is black and the minority, who are in control of everything, are white.
Interesting.
No, they were so surprised that was not the case.
Wow.
Asian students, we had some from China, Taiwan, China, but they were here for a specific field of study, a degree, and they worked night and day to achieve it in the shortest period of time possible, and went home to fulfill the job that they had been, on whose behalf they had been sent, you know. Didn't mingle very much with other students or anybody. You know, they were that single-minded.
Wow.
So that was an interesting change, because they were here, they saw it as part of their job to get through this study program as quickly as possible, and nothing stood in the way of that.
I forgot to ask, what was it like being not only, you know, in the inaugural class of Bologna, but being a woman there?
Yeah, of like 42, 43 students that were there.
You said about eight were women?
There were eight. I think eight women.
And how was that?
That wasn't at all... That was pretty par for the course in those days. This was the Middle Ages. I mean, women just didn't do things like this.
Right, exactly.
They didn't travel by themselves, and if they went to college, they got married and started raising families. So this was unusual. The Europeans were not surprised, though.
Really?
No, I didn't think that they found it at all surprising that they had to share a classroom with women. They enjoyed the fact that we were there. But it was a different time. It was a different time.
Did you ever feel uncomfortable, or was
no,
it just
never
normal?
Yeah, it was, we had, you know, fraternal relations. we were just another student, you know. It was there was really no feeling of separateness. Of course, you know, the school had set up dormitory facilities for all the men students. The women were the ones that had to go out in the marketplace and find a place to live.
And that was
with
true.
Some help from the school administrators, you know, but... yeah, I mean, the men came first, because they knew they would be the main part of the student body, and the women kind of were an afterthought.
But that's impressive that there were women at all. I mean, my college didn't admit women until 1969, so.
And, you know, this is, Hunter College, which is my undergraduate school, was all girls.
Oh, okay.
In its beginnings. And it wasn't really till the GI Bill of Rights that men started going to Hunter, but Hunter was one of the five City of New York universities. Mm-hmm. Residents of the city with the appropriate grade level mm-hmm. were entitled to free education at any of these city universities. Mm-hmm. And the men were permitted, men students were permitted at the other four. Mm-hmm. Hunter was the only one that was for girls only. Mm-hmm. And it was one of my counselors in high school that told me, apply to Hunter College, you'll be happy there. Mm-hmm. It was one of the smaller colleges, and I felt very protected there. It was also a situation where when you mixed women and men in classes, men always had the most to say and were the ones most recognized to speak. Mm-hmm. When you had a class full of women, women did get more of a chance mm-hmm. to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think it was, developmentally, it was a good choice.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Because by the time you got to grad school, you were used to speaking. Did you feel extraordinary or special?
No.
At all?
No.
When you?
No. My kids tell me this. Mom, you know what you did is really extraordinary. Uh-huh. Why? Well, because they said in those days women didn't do what you did. It showed quite a bit of pluck and courage to get up and do that. I said, I don't know. It was just doing what was interesting to me to do. Mm-hmm. And my family didn't stop me. They were very conservative. Kind of, I came from a very protected environment, you know. But my father, who was an immigrant, thought it was so wonderful that I would have an opportunity where the school would pay for me to go visit the country he lived in, mm-hmm. or came from, or whatever. My mother was born in the States, but her parents were also immigrants. So she thought, oh, what a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, have you filled in that application yet?
They weren't so thrilled with East Africa, though.
Oh, yeah, but they said they could have, the Foreign Service could have done without sending me to East Africa. But I said, well, it wouldn't have been a choice if they had given me the choice. But I said, what a wonderful opportunity to learn something you would never otherwise have known. And then as it turned out, I met my husband there, so.
She was the first woman Foreign Service officer in East Africa.
Oh,
there was a big write-up in the paper.
The local paper made a big deal about it.
Wow.
They said, no blue stocking, this Emma Bernardin.
Do you have a copy of that article?
Oh, back home I do.
That's so great. Wow.
Oh, that was interesting.
And again, there you just felt like that was just the normal thing to do for you, or did that...
I tell you, I followed my interests. I never thought of any of this as being extraordinary. I was just so happy to be doing something that I was interested in. That was not boring. It was not dull. I worked with really wonderful people who were very accepting of my role there. After I was in Kampala, the other Foreign Service officer was reassigned. And the person who came to replace him turned out to be someone that I had gone to the Foreign Service Institute with. So we didn't know each other well, but we knew each other by name and sight, you know. He and I shared an office. And when he'd get very blustery mm-hmm. in a phone conversation or something, I'd kind of tease him. Well, one day, the consul calls me into the office and says, Emma, you gotta let up on this poor Hap. You're driving him crazy. I said, why? I said, he said, well, you know, when he has a business call or whatever, you know, you're always making fun of the fact that he gets so pompous and all that. I said, well, he does. He says, well, maybe he does, but you know, we men, we have such fragile egos. You've got to put up with it. Stop making fun of him. You're really annoying him. I said, I'm sorry. I won't do it again. But that was about it, you know. You know, so I had to go apologize. Hap, I really won't tease you, but you just got to stop being so pompous.
Things haven't changed much.
That's great.
Three o'clock.
Well, are we ready to head back down? Oh, is it 3 o'clock? Oh,
just
okay.
About.
Perfect. Oh, wow. Timing. I guess we'll head back downstairs. Turn this off.